two texts today, one at the very beginning, one at the very end. In Exodus chapter 3. Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" Well, of course, it's a complex theological issue, the name of God. It's most often translated Yahweh. And that name in Hebrew is so revered by especially Orthodox Jews that it is only uttered aloud on the high holy day of Yom Kippur, and only then by the chief rabbi, and then only once. I am. A notion that has less to do with activity than of being. The great 20th century theologian Paul Tillich was reluctant to try to minimize the godness of God by using God's name, but rather referred to the divine as the ground of being. Being, I am. All of these notions have more to do with a sense of identity rather than activity, and they're all derivations of the English word to be. I am who I am, ground of being. Which is to suggest that the name of God is so complex and in many ways unfathomable that to conceptualize it in a word is to reduce it. Well, that's an intriguing idea. We have a friend of a friend who I don't know well, but these days you don't have to know somebody very well to get inside their heads and their hearts because we have the internet. And this friend of this person sent us a link to his blog. And what he's blogging about these days is the run-up to, and now subsequently, the aftermath of having some significant neurosurgery. Well, this blog entry that I'm going to quote briefly from occurred about 3 weeks ago, and it was about a week and a half in advance of when this surgery was to occur, which has now occurred, and he's doing well. So I'm pleased to report that. Anyway, he says this: "There's nothing like a medical crisis and Sunday to make you think about God. I actually think about God every day, but don't talk too much to other people about it. Sometimes I think it would be an easier conversation if I had another name for God. Lots of people seem to have very clearly defined beliefs of what God is. I guess my fear," and this is, I think, the key point that he makes here, "I guess my fear is that when I say that word, what I'm trying to communicate or express is immediately lost in the other person's translation." In other words, we all carry around images and ideas of what God is, and sometimes communicating about God gets lost in translation. Well, he comes up with an alternative. He says, "I think a different name that is gender neutral would be good. Maybe Leslie, Robin, or Sydney. I really like Sydney, but I think I'll shorten it to Sid with a Y. That way it sounds a little more spiritual. I'm not sure why. Maybe it reminds me of Siddhartha. I encounter Sid most predictably when I meditate." And he goes on to say, "Sid seems to show up in that quiet space when I can stop thinking long enough. I'm less preoccupied with my own ideas, and I have time to be quiet and listen." Well, that's where Sid shows up. We were sort of intrigued by that. We have a grandniece whose name is Sydney, and she was 2 years old this last week. And I'm not sure that her parents would regard her as an incarnation of the divine heading into the terrible twos, but who knows? In any case, it's an intriguing idea that there's more to a name that we initially think about, and that the very naming of something runs the risk of it being reductionary. So I want to talk about the complexities of naming, the naming of God, the naming of each other, and living, in a sense, in his name. Fair enough? What do we do with our names? Well, on a very practical level, We affix our names to contracts. We sign up for things. We sign up for bank accounts. We sign up for classes. We sign our names to mortgages and car loans. We sign our names to credit card slips. And in some sense, the signing of our name to a contract implies a promise to which we are held legally accountable. When you think about those things that you have signed, it reflects a kind of ethic. The signing of a credit card slip, which we do almost without thinking, pretty much every day, implies a promise that at the end of the month you'll pay the bill. Well, we generally do that. But the thing is, we are held accountable for what we sign and affix our names to. And in one sense, it's a measure of our work ethic. We deal with contractors from time to time, and you know, the remodeling of or fixing our home, or in this last week, fixing some plumbing. And over the last few years, maybe some cynicism has crept into my life. We're actually astounded, when someone who in advance agrees to do something at a particular time and in a particular way and for a specific price, and at the end of the event actually showed up on time, did the work for the amount agreed on. We find that stunning. But it's in effect a kind of, there's an accountability that goes with the simple signing of our name that we don't think about very often. And it's useful to think about, because who we are is reflected by what we do. And how we do it reflects, in a sense, holding up our end in His name. We sign our names or affix our names to contracts. Secondly, our names are also tied to our achievements. Maybe it's a diploma or some other kind of credential that we've earned over the years, and there's a piece of paper that has our name on it. This signifies that your name here has done this, completed that, or in some way earned the right to say, this is who I am. And these credentials that we accumulate in a variety of ways, whether it be an advanced degree from an academic institution or a membership in Senior Softball USA, doesn't matter. These things reflect what we value. They, in effect, become the kind of prefix to our names. And there are some rather dramatic examples of this, and I want to use this to illustrate the point. On a lesser level, all of us have this sort of prefix to our names based on what we've been able to accomplish in our lives, and our accomplishments reflect our values. Imagine someone who has been awarded the Nobel Prize. They forever become, their name in effect becomes Nobel Prize winner Elie Wiesel, or wins an Olympic gold medal. They become forever Olympic gold medalist Michael Phelps, or Academy Award. The Academy Awards are coming up in a couple weeks. Meryl Streep is again nominated. She's won several times. Academy Award winner, Meryl Streep. Well, just as an exercise in sort of values clarification, think for a moment. Imagine that you could have one of those three. Imagine that you could affix to your own name a prefix that would either be Nobel winner, Academy Award, Olympic gold medalist. Let's vote. I'd like to know kind of where we are here. How many of you would say of those three, if I could have one, it would be the Nobel Prize? How many of you would say if I could have one of those three, it would be an Olympic gold medal, an Academy Award? Nobody else but me. I'm sorry to say that's true. There's a performance aspect to what I'm doing now. There's a performance aspect to what I do during the week at Tech. I have this fantasy that Steven Spielberg's grandnephew, twice removed, will show up in my class and call up Uncle Steve and say, you've got to put this guy in one of your movies. Probably not going to happen. But the point is, these decisions, even these ideas, reflect what we value. And what we value becomes, in effect, affixed to or even part of our names. We affix our names to contracts, and it sets up a work ethic. We attach our names to achievement, and it reflects what we value. And we also attach our names to our spouses and our kids. There's a convention in U.S. society and in others as well that when Mary Smith becomes the spouse of John Jones, she then becomes Mary Jones and takes on his name. I don't think that that's a trivial issue. It goes back historically and culturally to many other things that a lot of us don't even think about from time to time. There was a time in not just the United States, but other places around the world, where a woman did not have an identity unless she was known as the daughter of so-and-so or the wife of so-and-so. And in fact, in many respects, could not even independently earn money or testify in court or in any other way act as an autonomous person other than being connected to the man to whom she was born or the husband that she had married. We even still ritualize this in weddings. There's this little moment that, well, pretty much every father of the bride wants to be part of, you know, where they gather up at the front and the question is, who gives this woman to be married to this man? Now let's parse the sentence a little bit. Who gives this woman to be married to this man? As though she is a piece of property to be handed over. Now, we don't often think of it that way. In fact, we sort of gloss over it. But the ritual makes it clear. The officiant then takes the hand of the woman from the father, hands it to the prospective about to be husband in a transfer of property rights. And then the line that typically occurs is, I do her father, or her mother and I do, if we're really egalitarian about it. Well, the more that this occurs in an age where women are autonomous and independent professionals before they are Mrs. So-and-so, there's some resistance to this. And yet, we want to be respectful of dad or grandfather who wants this to occur. I mean, there's this tension between tradition and, you know, what it really means when you think about it a little. And women these days are thinking about it. I have a fix. I wish I'd come up with this myself. Actually, I saw it on a TV show. Not the most noble of places to come up with a fix for this, but there is one, I think. If the question must remain in a wedding ceremony, who gives this woman to be married to this man, someone on her behalf might use this as the answer. She gives herself freely with our blessing. And that gets at the heart of what the biblical understanding of marriage is anyway, the giving of oneself to one another. They give themselves freely with our blessing. Thus, we become part of this process by choice, not by force or convention. We affix our names to the people who love us the most. We affix our names to our children. I am named for someone who loves me very much. My first and middle names are the reverse of the first and middle names of my father. So every time I sign my name, I'm in effect saying, I identify myself as the son of this person. And there's a level of responsibility that goes with that. That, in a metaphorical way, if not a literal way, is true for all of us through our baptism. There's a part of the baptismal liturgy where the officiant says, how shall this child be named? And we typically use the first and middle names. Jerome Richard, child of God, is baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. In the name of. We are named in the name of. In effect, we carry the name of God ourselves as we are baptized in his name. The second text for these thoughts comes from Matthew's gospel, although it appears in a couple of other places. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to John to be baptized by him. And when Jesus was baptized, he went up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened. And he saw the Spirit of God descending on him like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. In effect, at baptism, we are granted by God's grace the kind of prefix to our name, even more amazing than Nobel Prize, Academy Award, or gold medal. We are given the name Beloved. in Greek, agapetos, from the root agape. Beloved is a name we all share. So however we are named idiosyncratically, however our names change throughout the course of our lives, the overriding identity of who we are, and we all share it together, is beloved. I think that will change our lives every time we remember it. So in honor of, if for no other reason, Valentine's Day this week, beloved of God, live in His name. Amen.